From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Remember the California preacher who said Judgment Day was imminent and the chosen ones would be transported to heaven in the coming rapture? Well, it didn't happen, but that hasn't stopped the frenzy for doomsday scenarios. So what about all those people now obsessing over a Mayan prophecy about the end of the world in 2012?
This date, which is written about in one Maya inscription, mentions the date December 21st, 2012, but they don't describe anything about it being the end of the world.
This hour, we'll take you behind some of today's most common doomsday scenarios. Also, the far more real threat of nuclear war.
You don't need there to be too many close calls. It's all a close call. We're all a few minutes, a simple human error or machine error from some catastrophic development.
Now, if we're going to talk about the cultural impact of end times, we almost have to start with this story. The apocalyptic showdown between God and Satan in the Bible's book of Revelation.
I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled.
Revelation is the last book in the Bible, and its most controversial book, according to renowned Princeton historian Elaine Pagels. Pagels is famous for her studies of the New Testament, especially the Gnostic Gospels. Now she's turned her attention to the book of Revelation. Pagels recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
How influential is the book of Revelation today?
The book of Revelation, weird as it is probably one of the most popular books in the New Testament. I mean, apart from the Gospels, there's nothing that's more widely read among some people. Some Christians love it and read it all the time, and some would never touch it.
Why? Why does this book resonate with so many people?
Well, that's a really good question, and I guess that started me out because, you know, the book is very strange. I think it's because it consists of dreams and nightmares. Visions. There's really no teaching in it. I mean, it's almost, you know, the way children dream or the way any of us dream.
Well, there's this whole apocalyptic nature to it, right? I mean, Christ as the terrifying warrior, Satan as a red dragon. I mean, it's the imagery is pretty stark.
The imagery is exactly why I think it is so powerful. I mean, it just has a universal appeal.
Is this just a very different kind of book than you find in the rest of the New Testament?
It's very different. You know, it didn't have any teaching of Jesus. In fact, it probably wasn't a Christian book in the beginning. It was written by John, who saw himself as a Jewish prophet in the tradition of the prophets. He wouldn't have called himself a Christian because he thought that meant those Gentiles who follow Paul, and he wasn't one of them. He didn't like them either. but he saw himself in the tradition of the great prophets, and Jesus as the chosen king of Israel, who was, although crucified and killed, was going to come back and rule the entire world. It's a vision that he elaborated from what he found in the prophets like Daniel, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah.
Do we know when the book of Revelation was written?
Yes, it was known by the end of the first century. So some people think it was written in the 60s, about 30 years after the death of Jesus. And most people think probably closer to the 90s, because it talks about certain emperors and sort of landmarks that you would have been able to see in what is now Turkey at the end of the first century.
So were there particular historical circumstances that John was reacting against as he was framing this prophecy?
Well, the whole book, I think, is wartime literature. It's the experiences of somebody who was probably a refugee from the Jewish war against Rome, in which Jews rebelled against Roman control in 66 and started a revolution. But they were completely wiped out by the Romans, and the city of Jerusalem completely destroyed, the center of Jerusalem charred to rubble by the year 70. And I think it was that horrifying, terrifying experience. But John thought that Jesus had prophesied it 30 years before, saying, well, Jesus said it would happen. Look, it's happened. Now he's about to come back.
So how does this play out then in the book of Revelation, this story of the rebellion against Rome and then being crushed by Rome?
You know, it's not told that way at all. It's all in a kind of wild apocalyptic code about the forces of evil as enormous dragons, the forces of good as Jesus on a white horse coming with the armies of heaven. So what you have is a sort of conflict between the forces of good and evil in the sort of wild supernatural. And it climaxes in a huge battle, the Battle of Armageddon, and the forces of good win, and the forces of evil are destroyed. And you realize that this is basically the structure of much of our drama. A movie like Star Wars or a movie like Lord of the Rings is all about forces of good against the forces of evil, and it's a terrible fight, and evil almost makes it but loses in the end, and so forth. And so this kind of story is fundamental to the way we think about drama.
Because the book of Revelation is so different from the other books in the New Testament, how did it get into the New Testament? I mean, we know that there were lots of things that were written back then. Some made it into the canon, became part of sort of the established Christian tradition. Lots of other things didn't make it in. Why did this book?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I think this kind of story about clash between good and evil is a way to make sense out of conflict, any conflict. It could be a conflict with your boss. It could be conflict with Al-Qaeda. It has a very deep appeal to people as a sort of sense that there is meaning in terrible conflict and even in terrible suffering and a kind of assurance that the good will win. But there are many other books of Revelation that didn't make it in, and they have a much more universal vision. So I've been thinking about the question you ask. I think I've come up with a guess.
Okay.
The person who put it in is somebody who was one of the architects of Orthodox Christianity. And he wanted to insist that you have to sign this creed, which he helped draft. His name is Athanasius. He was the Archbishop of Egypt. And you have to join the Orthodox Church and give up all your crazy ideas. And that way you'll be saved. Otherwise, you're going into certain hell and destruction. And this book is the perfect way to cap the collection, because what he did was write a commentary explaining that the people who go into eternal hell and fire and damnation are the heretics, the people who are his enemies. That is, he put his own conflict into it. And the people who go into, you know, the New Jerusalem are the Orthodox Christians who believe and sign the right creed. So he reinterpreted the whole thing and sort of updated it, as people always do. And it worked very well for his purpose.
And when was that?
That was in 367.
Okay, he wrote a letter. Hundreds of years after John of Patmos actually wrote this book.
Yes, it was nearly 300 years after John wrote. It was used for a very different purpose.
It sounds like there was this attempt to separate out the Orthodox Christians, the good Christians, from the heretics. Were the heretics the bad Christians, or were they the pagans?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, they were the Christians that didn't believe things the way Athanasius did. So he wanted to insist that there was only one kind of Christianity and not different points of view. And he was working under the patronage of a Christian emperor who had military force to support it. And that emperor, well, from Constantine on, the emperors who were Christian wanted to unify the empire under one kind of Christianity. So that meant you can't have a lot of kinds. So his purpose was to destroy the heretics, as they were called.
And what were some of the messages of the heretics? I mean, what were the versions of Christianity that did not make it?
Well, significantly, the versions of the Christianity that didn't make it said you didn't need the church, and you didn't need the priest, you didn't need the bishops. You could find God by some kind of solitary search on your own, but they were much more independent kind of spiritual paths that didn't require the institutional church that Athanasius was trying to establish.
Now, do you think the book of Revelation was intended to be read literally?
Well, it was intended to be read as sort of God's victory will triumph over the forces of evil. You can't really read it literally. I don't think so. But you don't have to read it literally to take it seriously. That is, to take it as a serious message of hope. I mean, it's been read for 2,000 years. It was read during the wars between Catholics and Protestants. It was read on both sides. It was read on both sides of the Civil War. It was read on both sides of World War II. It's read on both sides of the current wars that are going on in the world. Because its imagery is so wild and so imaginative. You can kind of plug it into any conflict you happen to have.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. My sense is that today in America, the Book of Revelation is taken particularly seriously by conservative Christians. And it's almost something of an embarrassment among a lot of liberal Christians.
Well, that's true because a lot of less conservative Christians feel that it's kind of been co-opted as it has. I mean, since the beginning of the 20th century, there were evangelical Christians who read the book and actually mapped out very specifically, you know, this means this and this means this, this means the Soviet Union and this means the United States and this means China and so forth. And they've revised it as the enemies shift and change. But it is being read, you know, in terms of the world map, in terms of world conflict.
How do you take it? You are a Christian yourself.
I've started out rather disliking it, but now that I've been working on it, I realize how powerful it is and how it works on people. I mean, artists have been drawn to it, poets like John Milton, artists like Blake, Bosch, Michelangelo, and contemporary artists. There's a huge amount of film and video games, all kinds of ways that this very powerful kind of imagery plays out. So I have a very mixed, ambivalent response to this book.
Now, I'm curious about why you became so interested in the Book of Revelation, because it would seem to be a departure from your earlier work on studying the history of the New Testament. I mean, you're best known for your work on the Gospels and the Gnostic Gospels, and this would seem to be very different.
Well, yes, except that, you see, with the secret Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, there were also found many, many texts called texts of revelation. And what I realize is that those revelations are very different. They're often about the divine that is present potentially in everyone, rather like a Buddhist teaching, you know, that a person could seek for enlightenment or that the divine is available in the world. Jewish mysticism says the same thing. And what I'm looking at, again, is how there are different ways to think about revelation than this way, this sort of end-of-the-world catastrophe.
Now, my sense, just having observed your career from afar in the books that you've written, is that you have a larger project here, which is to try to historicize the books, particularly in the New Testament, to make the point that these were not just dictated by God. They were real people who wrote them, often with their own particular agendas. Am I getting that right?
You're very right. And the reason for that is that most people, particularly in America, which is such a religious country, we don't learn about religion. You know, most people think about whatever they heard when they were five or didn't hear, and they either are for it or against it, but they don't think about it the way you think about biology or politics or hygiene. Or we learn about almost everything if we have the opportunity to be educated, except religion.
So how does that change the person of faith then? I mean, having this historical context and sort of recognizing that there were these contests between different visions of Christianity.
Well, a person who grows up in a Christian church can say, not, do you believe it or do you not? Are you an atheist or are you not? Somebody like Richard Dawkins says, you know, I'm an atheist, because they just believe total nonsense. And he caricatures the childishness of Christian belief, because that is the level at which many Christians do believe or not, right? It's yes or no to that, whatever set of beliefs you have in your mind. But when you look at it this way, the person who grows up that way can say, well, this part of it I deeply value, I treasure. There's truth in this. But there's also other things mixed in with it that I don't accept at all. And so it allows people to have a much wider range of choices and reflection about how they relate to these traditions than either is it yes or no.
That's historian Elaine Pagels talking with Steve Paulson. Her 1979 book, The Gnostic Gospels, won both the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and was chosen by the Modern Library as one of the 100 best books of the 20th century. She's now writing a study of the Book of Revelation. So what do you think about the Book of Revelation and other end times prophecies? We'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts by emailing us through our website at ttbook.org, and check out the new features on our website while you're there. Thank you. Coming up, just what is the Mayan prophecy about December 21st, 2012? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
I'm Shannon O'Malley, author of Apocalypse Cakes, Recipes for the End. Apocalypse Cakes is a cookbook of 30 cake recipes, and they're all in homage to apocalyptic eventualities. The first one I'll tell you about is the 2012 Mayan chocolate cupcakes. Basically, the 2012 Mayan chocolate cupcakes anticipate the end of the Mayan calendar, which is supposedly December 21st, 2012. Now, on this date, we're not only in for the return of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent deity, who I believe will punish us for doing things like selling keychain souvenirs of him at the Cancun Radisson, but I think we're also in for things like solar storms and a collision with something called Planet X, and also the sun's galactic alignment with a supermassive black hole that will initiate a global psilocybin mushroom experience. As for actually making the cupcakes, the 2012 Mayan chocolate cupcakes are basically just regular chocolate cupcakes with the usual pinches of cinnamon and chili powder. But you've got to make them in batches of 20 so that you can arrange them in the form of the Mayan calendar. That way, you'll be able to tell how much time you have left to stuff your face with these cupcakes before the collapse of the Aquarian Age.
Okay. What about that Mayan prophecy? We figured we should check in with an expert, so we found archaeologist David Stewart, one of the world's authorities on ancient Mayan culture. He's the author of The Order of Days, The Maya World, and The Truth About 2012. So, did the Maya predict the world will come crashing down on December 21st, 2012?
Absolutely not. The Maya calendar, or any ancient records from Maya civilization, say nothing about the world ending or anything of the sort.
There is a date, though, on a tablet, December 21st, 2012. I mean, I suppose I can even see why that might be so appealing, the 12-21-2012 thing. I mean, it sounds like ought to be a prophecy. And of course, it's the solstice, which we've all learned is is important.
Yeah, that's certainly a component to it. This date, which is written about in one Maya inscription dating to the 8th century A.D., mentions the date December 21st, 2012. Now, why would the ancient Maya talk about this? It turns out that it is a meaningful date in that it is a station in their particular calendar we call the long count. Think of it like the odometer of your car. It's like hitting 100,000 miles. It's the end or the turning point of a very large period of time, but they don't describe anything about it being the end of the world. So the date is real, but we just don't quite know what they're thinking.
So you think it's really us, that we're the ones who are investing this date with some kind of big notion. It's not the Mayans at all or the Maya at all.
You know, I think it does say more about our society, our culture, our worry points, you know, like Y2K or other ones that have existed. It doesn't come from the ancient Maya or what we know about the ancient Maya. I think it comes from a lot of anxiety in our own culture.
You are very clear about what we know of the ancient Maya. I think the public at large, myself included, are not as clear. We have images that come largely from movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark that present us with a culture that you could imagine would have end-of-the-world prophecies.
Yeah, the pop culture sort of vision of the ancient Maya is certainly a bit different from what archaeology tells us, but there are some overlaps there. I mean, the Maya have always fascinated us, our society, our culture, since the 19th century. There's been this kind of romantic view of a jungle civilization, a lost civilization with these abandoned cities in the rainforest and so forth. And that's definitely fed into this whole kind of Indiana Jones iconography, the symbolism of these lost cities and the romance of all of that. And that's one reason why I became an archaeologist, let's face it. It's really fun. It's wonderful to travel down in this area and get sweaty and dirty in the jungle and find new things, which we're doing all the time.
So in 25 words or less, can you clear it up a little for me? Can you give us the essence of what we do know about the Maya as they actually existed?
Yeah. Well, Maya civilization, one of the great civilizations of the world, it lasted for a good 2,000 years before the Spanish arrived. And, you know, we have many lost cities, many ruins. People visit them today. Some of them are explored by archaeologists. Many of them aren't. We have historical records, which we've just deciphered in the last 20 years. You know, it's astounding what we are finding nowadays, just in the last few years.
Well, 20 years is nothing in archaeological research time, is it?
Absolutely. It's all very recent in my lifetime. We have a whole ancient world that's opening up for us. It's a bit like I think Egyptology was maybe back in the 1840s or 50s. You know, the glyphs were deciphered, the hieroglyphs were deciphered, and you have all of this stuff to read and all of this stuff to wonder about. And the irony to me is that at this exciting moment, we are confronted with all of this false information about 2012 and prophecies of apocalypse and all this nonsense.
Well, but, you know, to some extent, it strikes me as logical that that should be the case because we know so little. I was surprised in reading The Order of Days to realize how little of what we know is there we've actually looked at. All of the ruins, it's some minuscule percentage that have actually been dug out. And there was there's mention in one place of discovering paintings.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. One of the most exciting things that's happened, and this was just 10 years ago, a project that I'm involved with, in fact, involved the discovery of the oldest wall paintings that we know about from the Maya world. And I guess they're probably among the oldest wall paintings from all of North America. In a temple in a site called San Bartolo in northern Guatemala. A friend of mine, my former graduate student, now my colleague, Bill Saturno, was exploring in the jungle, walks into a looter's excavation in a tree-covered pyramid and looks up and sees these paintings. It's changed our world in terms of archaeology, what we know about ancient Maya religion. It's like the Sistine Chapel. You have all these gods and origin myths and so forth depicted, and we're still working on it. I mean, we're still documenting it.
Let's talk a little bit about what we do know about the Maya. We do believe that they had some skill as astronomers, and we also know that they had very strict rules for timekeeping. Mm-hmm. They just happen to be different from ours, right?
Quite different. And the Maya came up with really an extraordinary mathematical construct. You know, this long count calendar, several different calendars, in fact, for counting days, for counting lunar cycles, for counting solar years, but also these much larger periods, you know, what they call the tunes and the baktuns, these ever-increasing periods that kind of get exponentially larger and larger.
Can we compare those to ours? A tun would be what in our terms?
What the Maya called a tun or a hab is basically means a year, but it was for a 360-day period. You know, our year, of course, is 365 days. But they wanted something that was about a year, but they were interested in the numerology of that because there were two sacred numbers. One is 13 and one is 20. And so 13 times 20 is 360. And that's the basic period of their long count, 360 days. 20 of those makes up another period, and then 20 of those makes up another period, and it just goes on and on and on.
And the baktun is this longer period that you're talking about once you put all of the tunes together.
Well, the baktun is 400 tunes, so it's 20 times 20 tunes. And yeah, that's a long period of 400 years, but they had much larger ones too. The full extent of the Maya calendar, and I had to do some serious number crunching to figure this out, the kind of full extent of their conception of time, if you do all the additions, approximates 72 octillion years. And, of course, that's a number that's just outrageous. It's way beyond our cosmology, you know, in terms of what physics tells us, you know, in terms of the age of our universe and its future. It's the largest concept of time, I think, ever conceived by a human culture.
I'm going to have to come back to the prophecy because, of course, that's what everybody is talking about these days. And I want to have a little better understanding, if that's possible, of the tablet, the Tortuguero tablet.
There's a site in Mexico, an archaeological site. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore. It was wiped out by a cement factory about 25 years ago. A site called Tortuguero in the state of Tabasco in southern Mexico. Thankfully, some sculptures were saved from the destruction of this place. And this one tablet from Tortuguero has a mention of what the Maya would have called the ending, the future ending of 13 baktuns. So remember, a baktun is one of these 400-year periods. And what they're saying basically is that on December the 21st, 2012, the 13th baktun will end.
No mention of a 14th baktun to follow.
Well, not in this tablet, but we do know there will be a 14th baktun. And this is the thing that a lot of people have missed. If you look at the full evidence from written Maya history, we know that there's a 14th baktun and a 15th baktun and a 16th and all of this. The calendar does not end. It keeps going. But they like the fact that it's 13. Remember, that's a sacred number that the Maya were really interested in. That doesn't say that anything beyond that will be ending.
David Stewart is a Mayanist scholar at the University of Texas. His book is called The Order of Days, The Maya World and the Truth About 2012. Do physicists also think about end times? Well, turns out Columbia University's Brian Greene does. So we asked him to describe what will happen to the universe in the very distant future.
There was a time when we thought maybe the universe would expand for a while, reach a maximal size, and then start contracting and end in a big crunch, as it was called. But recent data has shown, surprisingly, that space is actually not slowing down in its expansion, as many of us would have thought 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but rather the expansion of space is speeding up. So if that's the case, the universe will not ever stop in its expansion. It's going faster and faster and faster, which suggests that it will get bigger and bigger and bigger, more and more spread out. So the far, far future of the universe will simply be an ever colder and ever more diffuse and ever more dilute cosmos. And frankly, it's hard to imagine life surviving into the far, far future because of that. The fact is, in the far future, we won't be able to see the distant galaxies that we use today to even determine that the universe is expanding. The way we know the universe is expanding, we look out into space, we see distant galaxies, we see them rushing away, and we basically measure their speed. In the far future, those distant galaxies will have drifted so far away that it will be impossible to see them. They will be moving away from us faster than the speed of light. Strange idea. We usually think nothing goes faster than the speed of light. They can, because space can expand at a speed faster than the speed of light. These distant galaxies will drift so far away and so fast away that we won't be able to see them. So very, very future astronomers, when they look into the deep sky, it'll be dark. You know, one can feel a sense of loss because of that. But, you know, who knows? Maybe by then, which is, you know, 100 billion years from now, we'll have figured out some way to manipulate the universe in a manner that maybe we can change the course of cosmic evolution. Who really knows? But I think it really speaks to something very human in us. Ultimately, we're all mortal, and we all, you know, fear our own demise. And I think many of us think about that either on a human scale or on a solar system scale or a galactic scale. And if you do the kind of work that I do, you think about it on a cosmic scale.
Brian Greene is a theoretical physicist and the best-selling author of The Hidden Reality. The music you're listening to was written by Philip Glass to accompany another one of Greene's books, Icarus at the Edge of Time. Coming up, why the apocalypse may be closer than we realize. We'll hear about the very real danger of nuclear war. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. I have to say, most of the talk about end times seems laughable. I mean, the Mayan prophecy, the rapture, it's hard to take any of this seriously. But cultural critic Ron Rosenbaum is deadly serious about the threat of nuclear war. He says it's the one doomsday scenario we simply don't want to think about. Anne Strainchamps talked with Rosenbaum about his book, How the End Begins, The Road to a Nuclear World War III.
I think that these days there's a widespread popular assumption, and maybe dating back to the end of the Cold War, that the immediate threat of nuclear war is by and large a thing of the past. Your book suggests that this is a terrible mistake to be making and that we should, in fact, be more worried about nuclear war.
Yeah, I think that, in fact, we're in a more dangerous and unstable situation regarding nuclear weapons than we were at the height of the Cold War, when there were two main nuclear adversaries, but they were talking, there was a hotline, there were negotiations. Now there are nine nuclear nations. There's one run by a madman, North Korea. There are nations that are run by theocrats. There's Pakistan, which has 200 nuclear warheads, and they're one bullet or one coup away of coming under the control of Taliban or Al-Qaeda elements. And so a regional nuclear war is a not unlikely prospect, and a regional nuclear war could escalate into a global nuclear war.
Wow. At the height of the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union each had enormous nuclear arsenals. I know there are more nuclear nations by now, but is the global nuclear arsenal as big, bigger, smaller?
Certainly the U.S. and USSR, or now Russia, have reduced their nuclear arsenals. They were at a ridiculous level of 20,000 operational nukes on either side, and now it's more like 2,500. However, those 2,500 nukes, which will be reduced somewhat by the new treaty, are on what's known as hair trigger alert, a 15-minute warning window. In other words, our policy is to launch our silo-based buried nuclear weapons before they can be destroyed by an incoming attack. And to do that, we may launch them on the basis of radar and satellite systems alone, signals rather than observation. And that means that we're at the peril of false positives. And there have been close calls, you know, where we have thought we were under nuclear attack and we almost launched our weapons. And
Wait, really? There have been close calls and we've come very close to nuclear war? When?
Well, one of the most dramatic ones was recounted by Zbigniew Brzezinski, no hothead, when he was National Security Advisor to President Carter in 1980. He got one of those 3 a.m. calls from the NORAD Warning Center inside the hollowed-out Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. And it said their screen showed that there were 220 nuclear weapons heading over the pole toward the U.S. He better call the president. You know, you have minutes before our missiles are going to be destroyed. We have to get ours launched. Brzezinski, fortunately, waited a few minutes or wiped the sleep from his eyes. Then he got another call, and they said, sorry, it was a mistake. There are 2,200, not 220, missiles heading our way. Then Brzezinski thought, well, I guess I better call the president. Fortunately, before he called the president, and this is all in his memoir and it's backed up by the testimony of other people in the nuclear chain of command, fortunately, it turned out the warning of a nuclear attack was based on training tapes, which had been late at night fed into the screens at the NORAD Warning Center for drill purposes. And they were mistaken for real. But nonetheless, we were in minutes of a full-scale nuclear war. When you have the ability to destroy the planet, it's almost as if you don't need there to be too many close calls. It's all a close call. We're all a few minutes, a simple human error or machine error from some catastrophic development.
Well, this makes it sound as though we've simply been very lucky that there's been no nuclear war broken out so far on the basis of, you know, false positives. But I thought the whole theory behind nuclear deterrence was that the more nations that have nukes, in some ways, the safer we all are. Because, you know, if you launch a strike against another nation, they're likely to strike back and destroy you.
That doesn't sound too safe to me. Deterrence worked when it was a bipolar US-USSR kind of thing. And it was clearly we were threatening each other with genocide. Now, you know, some dissident nuclear commander in Pakistan could decide he is angry at some other nation in the Middle East. And so there are a number of danger spots where a regional nuclear war at the very least could flare up.
Well, one country, Middle Eastern country, that must have many plans in place for possible nuclear escalation is Israel. How is Israel dealing with the threat of nuclear war?
Well, it's a very tense matter. Israel does not declare officially that it has nuclear weapons, yet it's estimated to have up to 200. And I devote some time in my book to the effect of the Holocaust on Israel's hair-trigger nuclear response. In other words, the people of Israel, Jews, have suffered one Holocaust. They're in a region where Pakistan has what it calls the Islamic bomb. Iran is building nuclear weapons.
So do the Israelis talk much about the danger of a second Holocaust?
Yes, actually. That phrase was first used as far back as 1967 when they were invaded by three nations. You know, the Israeli historian Benny Morris wrote a long essay about how the next Holocaust will be different. In other words, it will be a push-button, disengaged, automatic-like affair as opposed to the hands-on Holocaust of Hitler and the SS.
Let's suppose nuclear war breaks out in the Middle East. Something escalates. Israel is attacked or Israel attacks. How many people do you think would die in a nuclear war in the Middle East?
In January 2010, Scientific American published a report on what the casualties from a small, quote-unquote, nuclear war, say between India and Pakistan, would be. And in addition to the millions that would be killed on the ground and from firestorms, et cetera, they said that the ash kicked up into the atmosphere would form a chilling shroud that would kill enough food crops to cause the death of a billion more people.
Yeah, this is such a terrifying story. I wonder whether sometimes people simply don't want to hear this, don't want to hear what you have to say.
I think that's true. In America, we're addicted in sort of a nice way to what someone has called solutionism. Well, there's got to be a solution to this problem. You know, we're Americans. We solve problems. It's got to be a solution to the Middle East. It's got to be a solution to nuclear weapons. The more I've studied this, the less I believe there is a solution, unfortunately. And that's the thing that people don't want to hear.
Ron Rosenbaum talked with Anne Strainchamps. His book is called How the End Begins, The Road to a Nuclear World War III.
I'm Shannon O'Malley, author of Apocalypse Cakes, Recipes for the End, and I'd like to tell you about one of my recipes. It's called Nuclear Winter Ice Cream Cake. Now, I love a nuclear winter ice cream cake, and so do world leaders, who can't wait to bust out their best nuclear arms, I believe, to ensure peace and also destroy you. And I think when that world leader does hit the button, 1,000 megatons of plutonium are going to transform all of the SUVs and Nordstroms and malls of America into skybound aerosol particles that will block the sun's light and provide us with a cozy little permanent winter. And when that happens, the temperature will always be just right for our ice cream and ice cream cake. Now, like all of my recipes, this is a pretty basic ice cream cake, but with a few alterations. You can burn some nuts and crunch them up and sprinkle them on top of your ice cream cake so they look like, you know, little charred bits. Or you can put some cayenne pepper in the chocolate. That way, you can serve it to your guests and they'll talk about how hot and burning the cake tastes. And that's the point at which you can remind them that nuclear meltdown is probably near and they should eat up before their faces are vaporized.
No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them.
Slavoj Žižek is the wild man of philosophy, or perhaps, as the Telegraph in London recently called him, the world's hippest philosopher. A native of Slovenia, he's president of the Society for Theoretical Psychoanalysis in Ljubljana and a professor at the University of London. But professor hardly begins to describe Žižek. In academic circles, he's a superstar and all-around provocateur. Žižek is a Marxist who infuriates many other Marxists. And for those not on the left, well, the New Republic called him the most dangerous philosopher in the West. Now, it so happens that Slavoj Žižek is fascinated by apocalyptic thinking. He's just written a book called Living in the End Times. Steve Paulson sat down with Žižek for a freewheeling conversation, talking about the hidden atheism of Christianity, the danger of poets in power, and the inherent limits of capitalism and liberal democracy.
I ask myself a simple question. Can this system survive in the long terms, or are there some ominous signs which point towards antagonisms which sooner or later will reach a certain end point? And my hypothesis is, yes, there are such antagonisms. And I think the most ominous trend, it's not only about anti-immigrant politics, it's a much wider problem about identity in our global world, and a new class of, let's call them excluded people, people who are somehow second-rate citizens from those who live in slums and so on, which is introducing slowly in our countries the logic of a kind of a silent but permanent civil war, where you get from time to time these apparently irrational explosions. Like you remember a couple of years ago in France when youth, not even gangs, thousands of them, were burning cars in Paris suburbs.
Right,
and how
right.
totally helpless. So listen, all I'm saying is this. If you try to build an image of the future, where we are heading, I claim we are approaching some kind of a zero point.
Let me ask you about one phrase you use. You say that we are living in a post-political age. What do you mean by that?
I see one rather catastrophic tendency after 1990. The political conflicts are more and more, at least in the developed countries, transformed into or perceived as cultural problems. Like if you talk, at least in the degenerate circles where I move, academics and so on, for example, for them, the problem of racism or sexism is not an eminently political problem, but it's mostly a problem of cultural tolerance, you know, all these boring topics. Why don't we tolerate the others? Let me give you what I think a proof of this tendency to culturalize politics. I checked online all speeches by Martin Luther King. You practically don't find the word tolerance in his writings. For him, it would have been humiliating to claim we blacks want more tolerance or whatever, no? Racism becomes an issue of tolerance when you depoliticize it, when The problem is no longer as it was for Martin Luther King, economic inequality, legal status, but it becomes a problem of cultural tolerance and so on. So then, of course, all you can do is say, let's tolerate each other.
Let me jump in here, and I want to come back to the idea of end times, because, of course, that phrase is usually used in a religious context, referring to the biblical prophecies of the coming apocalypse. And I know you are very interested in religion, even though, as far as I can tell, you're an atheist.
1,000% atheist.
And yet, you seem to be very attracted to Christianity. In fact, you have called yourself at times a Christian materialist.
Or a Christian atheist, whatever. but I wrote 3 books about Christianity where I read Christianity as not only an atheist religion in its radical core, but as a necessary step for being an atheist today. The message of Christianity is for me something very precise. It all begins with, I think, the most maybe subversive text in the entire history of religions, in the Old Testament, the Book of Job. You know what's the message of the Book of Job? Job protests not that he's innocent, but that his suffering doesn't have any meaning. In contrast to the 3 idiots, theological friends, who came to comfort him, and each of them is basically telling Job, no, your suffering has some meaning, maybe you did some blah, blah. Then God comes and tells Job, no, you are right, the 3 idiots are wrong. It has no meaning. Then when Job asks God, but then, okay. Now, I know on the radio you don't say dirty words, so I will say, okay, 4-letter word, up. Why then did this happen to me? And you know what God basically says is, it's extraordinary if you read it really closely. What God basically says is, listen, you think you are in deep S, 3 points. don't you see the creation? Everything is a big mess. Like God, in a way, concedes his own confusion. There is no order. And I think the death of Christ confirmed this. As Hegel, my favorite philosopher, put it, the death of Christ is the death of God himself.
So it sounds like you're saying that we had to go through this Christian history. And,
absolutely.
And your
the only way to be an atheist is to go through Christianity.
And in your definition, the particular version of Christian history where Christ dies, and only then can we come to sort of the sense of common humanity, except for you're saying, you know, forget about any kind of divine rapture at the end.
Yeah. It means, for me, the death of Christ and the arrival of Holy Ghost, it means we don't have any guarantee in some big other destiny, historical necessity. We are left alone. We only can build Holy Ghost, which means an emancipatory community.
Now, you are a philosopher, and quite a famous philosopher at that, but I have to ask...
Más o menos, as they say it in Spanish, more or less.
Now, some people would say philosophy, more than anything, should offer some wisdom for how to live, even how to be
happy.
I'm
opposed to wisdom. Here I am Christian. No.
This is not
my
the job
Stalinist
of philosophy.
Universe, you know, people like to accuse me, like the New Republic idiots, of being a covert Stalinist. Okay, so I have to live up to this reputation, no? In my gulag, when I take power, you know, people like Alain de Botton and all these wisdom philosophers, no? They are the first to disappear in gulag. Not just re-education gulag.
Plato wanted to banish the artists. You're going to banish the happy philosophers.
My thesis is quite seriously. There is no ethnic cleansing without a poet behind laying the ground for it. It's easy to laugh at Radovan Karadzic. All nations have people like Karadzic, not so brutal, even to look at other cases of ethnic cleansing. And I always discovered a Karadzic behind. Like, you remember Tutsi, Hutu, 10 years ago, or when it was?
In Rwanda,
in
sure.
Rwanda. Ah, there is a poet behind. Who in a local literary journal for 10 years was systematically spreading ethnic hatred and so on and so on. To avoid a misunderstanding, I admire tremendously great poets. But also we should be aware how poets can also play a very dark role in every ethnic cleansing or violence. You know, people have a certain minimum of decency. Like, let's be frank. If somebody would tell me, rape your daughter and take a knife and take out your eyes, I would have found it a little bit difficult to do.
I hope so.
So what you need is a strong national mythic religious motivation. A very strong story should be told to you. No? Here the poets enter.
And what about the philosophers then? What's the role of...
Poets are much worse here. I think we philosophers do nonetheless a little bit better. Beware of poets in power. This is why in my text on ex-Yugoslav war, I said that we in Balkan are in a much worse position than you in the States or in the West. You have the so-called industrial military complex. We have a poetic military complex. Poets and military. The collision between them is much more dangerous than the industrial military complex.
Slavoj Žižek is a Slovenian philosopher and the author of Living in the End Times. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
I'm Shannon O'Malley, author of Apocalypse Cakes, Recipes for the End. I've got a recipe here I want to share with you. It's for Robot Uprising Artificial Food Cake. When I invented this recipe, I was thinking it's probably only a matter of time before something happens like my vacuum cleaner and my iPhone join forces to microwave my rear and post a photo of it on Facebook. You know, after 150 years of industrial advancement, machines have become these complex, abused organisms that we've enslaved to meet our vapid capitalist ends. You know, my iPad is definitely reading Marx and figuring out how to punish me for forcing it to process Excel spreadsheets and my dumb family vacation photos. Now, the actual Robot Uprising Artificial Food Cake is basically frozen black jello, and it's got some mechanical parts on top. In my book, we've placed small, decorous ball bearings on the top of the jello block as a nice little garnish. But really, I mean, when you make it, you can put whatever you want on it, as long as it looks alienating and unappetizing.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Waiting for the Apocalypse, number 87A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Today's engineer is Steve Gotcher. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.